Conference record has joined the conference.
Okay. All right. So I'll put down George or representative.
Yeah.
A friend of mine. Okay. All right. Actuarially sound and sufficient, underlined, to to support provision of COVID long-term care services and care coordination. Joanne.
I would just ask that we consider doing something on timeliness in terms of getting the rates out to the providers, giving them up bad notice so that we know what we're operating on while we're operating in that
frame. Okay. Eli, you had a point you wanted to make on payments, even though I think it was number two.
Well, it's number two. One of the things I would suggest, we have the benefit package to promote the appropriate, I would put a comma, efficient, and then I would add, and effective use of services for which it is responsible. But you can be very efficient and not very effective. So I think it has to be both efficient. The outcome is very important.
Okay, Helen.
I know we're going to hopefully add a bullet on continuity of care, but it might be appropriate to also include continuity of care in the last sentence for the provision of longer care services and care coordination and transition.
Okay. All right. We are going to do something on a separate principle on the transition. Okay, Carol.
With respect to number 10, could you clarify whether or not care coordination is an administrative cost or service cost? Because if these models have to take on more coordination, that becomes an issue.
In the NLR? You mean for like NLR calculation purposes?
Mm-hmm.
Currently, for what is it?
Well, care management sits outside of the
it's
medical
cost. It's outside, that's
admin.
My point.
Yeah, right. So I mean, I guess what's your in terms? What? Yeah.
I mean, both will be incorporated within
the
rate.
Overall payment.
Right.
But in terms as you adjust administrative costs down at
right.
the same time that the plans are having to coordinate more,
well, that's a
that
good
needs
point.
To be taken into account.
And basically, adequacy of the administrative payment to meet the needs of special population.
Well, it's really
it's
a question as
that.
To whether it's more than that.
It's more than that
because you have the same problems with Medicare plans. You know, care coordination, if you have care coordination and the intent is to reduce admissions to hospitals and readmissions to hospitals, it's not an administrative function in terms of its role. Its role is really part of your medical loss ratio. And so, you know, the question of who's doing it is one thing, but how you calculate it and where it goes is something else. Because if you put it in as part of your administrative course, then you may end up with significantly higher administrative costs than what you might want to be compared to.
So you're worried about having a low MLR.
Low MLR, yeah. I think it belongs in the MLR. I believe it belongs in the
MLR. Related to the whole ACA, what MLRs are.
Yeah. Yes.
I think this is sort of a more complex issue that we need
is.
To spend some time on.
And it's a crossover issue with other workers.
But it's a covered,
right?
Which is added to the state plan as a fee for service benefit.
Right.
So you should be able to include it
actually,
as a medical benefit
in administration.
Yeah.
The MLR in a revised
right.
MLR calculation.
I know what you're talking about. Yeah, you're worried. What we're worried about is that we will be out of compliance.
You will artificially depress
requirements. Okay.
But I think overall, there is an issue that you want to keep. You often are trying to bring down administrative costs.
That's correct.
And then this could be
right.
counterproductive.
Sure.
And it's the first thing you cut.
Right. We're scheduled to cut
it.
I think there should also be, from a principal standpoint, the development and implementation of a quality incentive program. It's based upon predetermined quality outcomes.
Yep. Should that be part of Carol's work group?
Well,
whether or not you want to design.
If the rates.
The
can,
measures
if the rates. Right.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think that's a little bit of a weakness of the current system is that
right.
on the mainstream side, commercial side, we have pay performance, well established, long standing. The question is, do we want to build that in? I think, yeah, absolutely. I mean, we put a lot of money at risk with mainstream plans.
3%
of cap. 2.5. Now. My last job, I used New York as a standard, and we went to 3.25.
Okay.
Okay. Does this still carry over to the payment reform group?
Yes.
I think this carries over to the payment reform group. A lot of things, not just whether there's quality incentives, but once we start talking about admissions and readmissions to hospitals, and who's accountable for that, and who gets penalized for that, and who gets paid for it, you know, that all gets mixed together. I think somehow we have to make that group.
Is that looking at long-term care management?
They haven't started yet. I think an invite is going out today to the potential members of the group. But we can, it might make sense to have a conversation with Dan Sisto and.
Okay. Okay. All right. Other questions on the risk adjusted payment? All right, then we're on to number.
I don't know if this is reflected in demographics or not, but someone of the same physical, mental status living in a home with other family members versus living alone, the costs are dramatically different. And so I don't know if the mechanism will take that into account, but I think it should.
So that demographic. Take into account your living status, whether you're living alone or with family.
Yeah, you've got a family providing support, or if we're looking at consumer-directed programs, all these things come together and have a significant impact in either direction on what the reimbursement really needs to be.
And who will be determining what other measures are? Risk factors include functional status factors, or other measures.
Well, I know there's a lot of work that we have done in establishing risk-adjusted premiums with mainstream plans, and Pat Ruin, who is the data person in OHIP, has done a lot of work with 3M and looking at it to determine how we would do an effective risk-adjusted methodology with the MLTC. And we rolled it out last year. I think their premiums were 75% cost report and 25% risk-adjusted. And it will move to 50%. And I think that we got some feedback from the industry on certain variables that should be adjusted for, like dementia and other things of that nature. And so he has been making some adjustments to the model. And as those things evolve, I think they should be added to that list.
This risk adjuster is very important because if we don't get it right, it really affects, you know, how the different CCMs will behave.
And can we look beyond personal care when we look at these factors?
Sure.
Oh, yeah, it does. It looks beyond. It's supposed to look at the comprehensive needs.
When you're talking about setting a rate, different populations may require different types of durable medical equipment.
Right? Yes.
If you have someone who has spinal cord injury, they may have to have special mattresses to avoid hospitalization, which costs a lot more than renting a hospital.
Okay. All right. Then we're on to number 11. CCM will provide adequate consumer protection for members. Members must be entitled to and be informed of their rights as members of the CCM. This includes the right to make complaints about the care and services provided, to have requests for services addressed timely, and to appeal decisions. Members should have the right to disenroll from the CCM on a month-to-month basis and join another provider of service. And that's required in the law that members be able to leave month-to-month.
No, I don't believe so.
Could you speak up, Ellen?
I know, it's not. She was asking whether the month-to-month disenrollment was it in statute, and it is not in statute.
Okay, Mark.
I think the month-to-month basis very problematic. I don't think there would be any level of continuity. I think that it will be difficult to provide meaningful care management. I think it will go back and forth and back and forth. And I think it will be an extraordinarily costly type of right. And I think it would ultimately not serve the best interest of the beneficiary. Having said that, I feel that this is all apple pie and motherhood up until that point. I think that there needs to be a statement in there, and my colleagues will probably not terribly be happy. there should be a reflection that the Department of Health should have sufficient resources for effective ongoing monitoring and oversight of the CCM. And in the absence thereof, that's going to be very, very problematic. Folks have asked, well, what happens when the LDSS goes out, and who's going to protect the consumer, and who's going to do that? It's the Department of Health that's going to be regulating it, and you've got to have the resources for ongoing, consistent monitoring and oversight. And today, that's not there in today's world.
Too, but more the opposite it is. If you're a consumer and you're in a plan and they're not able to provide you or willing to provide you with what you feel is necessary or have the expertise to do that, you're stuck then.
Well, you're not stuck. Like in the mainstream plan, you've got, you know, a lock-in. And
how long is the lock-in in the mainstream?
Lock-in is a year. After the first 90 days, it's a year. But during that time period, we should be evaluated. Do we have all the right? Is the infrastructure there? Is the network sufficient? So all those things should have been done well in advance before all of a sudden we found out that we didn't have a hospital in Oneida County. So I think that will create.
But if you look at it from the point of view, you have someone coming into the system new who's never been in long-term community care at the time, and they don't know what they will need, or they have a daughter who's willing to provide certain things, be an informal support and all, and then that changes, for argument's sake, well, I need a power wheelchair now because my daughter, who doesn't live here anymore, can't do the shopping, and I have to say that's no.
But that's an issue.
Appeal.
That's an appeal.
In the meantime, if you can't disenroll, if your process takes so long now.
But that's why I'm suggesting
the external appeal takes so long now to be a hearing that you're talking about 2 months, usually 6 weeks, before you can get a hearing date.
I think that needs to be fixed.
Right. But think about this, though, this issue in terms of in a mandatory managed long term care environment. If you opt out of managed, if you want to change, basically what you do is you have to transition from one managed long-term care provider to another.
And there was a mechanism for doing that with the local social services district working with you to do that, so that you had a guarantee that the enrollment was done, that the person voluntarily chooses to disenroll, the local social services district requires a conversion plan, and then they would.
So the issue is that if you want to switch plans, there is a vehicle that applies to mainstream, would apply here as well, through Maximus, the contractor the state has, where you can call a 1-800 number, and if you want to change plans, we have the policy is the policy in terms of, you know, how frequently you can do it, which is a good conversation. But then that what you in essence would do is that managed long-term care plan, or that, I'm sorry, Maximus would in essence assist a person in understanding what their options were, what the other alternatives were, and assist them and then enrolling into that new plan. So I think that's in essence what the assumptions are going into this. But I do think it's a good question because there's flip sides to like a lot of these issues. Allowing monthly disenrollment to a health plan and to a consumer can be potentially problematic.
Right. Yeah.
It's problematic in the sense that if I'm a health plan, it's hard for me to predict my financial situation. I can invest some resources into care management, but that person could be gone. That investment I just made is now lost. It can create disruption. Member bounces back and forth between providers, not always necessarily a good thing. That said, locking someone in for a year, can also be a challenge. And I think there are midway points between those things.
Right.
That we could potentially explore to sort of balance that a little bit more. You know, mainstream at a year, with basically first 90 days, so a new applicant, like you said, within those first 90 days, they don't like what they see, they can switch. That's currently the mainstream policy. But after that, do you lock them in for a year? Do you lock them in for 6 months? I think there's maybe a happy medium that you could get to that would work for the consumer and for the patient. But it is an important issue because right now you can opt out. You don't like it, you opt out, but you opt out into fee-for-service.
Right.
Or another plan.
Or another plan.
If there's another
okay,
plan.
Doug.
I think if the month-to-month, enrollment is sort of taken off the table, I think it points to sort of the need to strengthen principle number six about the way sort of, at least in the Medicare world, folks who are eligible for a Medicare savings program and extra help are not locked in as the traditional Medicare population. And the way we sort of see this arise most often is that the consumer encounters sort of an unanticipated need and the plan doesn't have the resources to provide, that particular plan doesn't have the resources to provide that need. So it strikes me that at least from the Medicare perspective, the item six would sort of be an important protection if the month-to-month disenrollment was sort of taken off the table.
Right. Okay. Any other questions? Yes, Joanne.
Well, something that I don't see here, either 11 or in six, is that whole question of having sufficient capacity in that region before you even roll out the mandated nature of a CCM. So I don't see it as one of our guiding principles, I would have thought. Minimally, you've got to cross that threshold first, which is that sufficient regional capacity to be able to move towards a mandatory system.
I think it's the intent, but I think we could certainly add a principle that would state that.
And that we could sort of tie that, because we're looking at a transition principle, and maybe we can put that in, Joanne, in a way that as we transition, there has to be capacity for choice and in the implement.
Right, because I think the reason it's not here right now is not because of an intent to leave it off, but more because this was the idea of these are principles for evaluating models. Are these the kinds of models that the state would approve, contractually? But I do think that there's something that says that it can't also include that, because those are key things the state's going to have to grapple with.
These are more the things that the models would have to adhere to, but we had the larger issue of continuity of care and now the issue of capacity that you've raised several times. We have to somehow capture that in something.
Do you anticipate that the care coordination models or plans would be allowed to disenroll people involuntarily?
I mean, it is the case today in the sense that you, for basically non-compliance, that doesn't happen very often.
They're very explicit in the mainstream contract. They're very explicit.
Yeah, I think this is in the long term. Yeah, I think in the long-term care context, in the long-term care context, this is possibly more challenging. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But there may be a lot of some individuals who will not be cooperative with care, and they may not rise to the level of incapacity to require a guardian, but they may not necessarily be the kind of patient that people are comfortable with, and they're having.
What
could wind up being disenrolled,
Mary?
I think we do see. First of all, I do think that they get themselves disenrolled, and I think they wind up in personal care. A number of them, or in adult protection services.
It's not mandatory. Anybody can opt out now if they choose. But the question is, does the plan?
We're talking about involuntary.
Well, I've seen that emerge with behavioral health problems and. I've seen it also with someone who's a substance abuser, and you sign a contract that they're not going to abuse substances, and they violate the contract.
Right.
So, but I think that is an issue in a mandatory system.
Yeah. Right. I think what we can do is look at the states that are already mandatory managed care, see what policies they have. Because, like, for instance, the state of Arizona never built a fee-for-service system. They were entirely managed care all the time. But the question is, for anybody who is in that situation, how do they manage that situation? But I think it's a very good point.
Jason, it's a little different, though. In a mainstream managed care, maybe you could decide, while that's being on, you don't need to be a doctor. But if in a long-term care program, any personal care, it can't wait to go through
that. Well, what I'm saying, though, is that Arizona is mandatory managed care for everybody.
I understand.
Long-term care included.
So if you're doing it like the example Carol would say, the process now for involuntary disenrollment is the local social services to make a determination whether to agree with you or to let the plan do it. And it's very right. When you do a conversion, all the services are put in place before the plan is out, so that the person does not have a period where they are not getting any services. And I mean, a lot of it, the people who fall into this category, you know, have issues that are interfering. They could be behavioral health. They could. We had someone whose wife was being a prostitute in one room, and we couldn't get workers to stay in one. But, you know, and these are really very real things.
Right, no, these are very, very good.
Welcome, Tom.
Someone may just decide that I don't like this care manager. I'm not going to cooperate. And then the plan couldn't move to this.
So I think what you're suggesting is we need to take a look at the current criteria for disenrollment, and then also think about how to ensure that what so if somebody is disenrolled, what happens.
I think that should be considered with Eli's committee.
Okay. And I have to add the state and local because this came up in the conversion. It
right.
also relates to the role of adult protective services going forward.
Okay.
Yeah.
That is true.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, Alan.
Also, for Eli Smitty, Marilyn mentioned before the length of time it takes for the hearings.
Yep.
The best way to protect individuals' rights is to make sure that it's a speedy process. Failure of voters ought to pick it up is a major problem.
But on that point, I was just thinking about, you know, we also have, and it's not used as frequently, but we have the external appeal process that recipients are, and they have an expedited process of 3 days.
Well, I mean, that's why I keep saying that there are multiple structures built within plan and outside of plan that consumers would be privy to,
yes.
And part of our goal is to make sure that that information is conveyed. Member handbook. They also complain to the department. I mean, we have several people that complain to the department before it gets to fair hearing or even an internal process. So there are no limitations on when that could occur.
But if your concern is members' rights might be trampled by voluntary disenrollment and denial of care during the interim process, finding some way to get speedy adjudication.
That's right.
It's the best way
to prevent
that.
Yep. Yep. Exactly.
Okay. All right. So we're going to go on to the last.
One more thing.
Oh, go ahead, Melanie.
I think there should be specific protections against unnecessary nursing facility placements and an external review of those placements when they happen. And it can be related potentially to the issue of one way to have data and have oversight of that final determination. I won't bring up all the other issues that are involved with that, but if we're looking specifically at, you know, what happens when people are placed in a nursing facility and who makes that decision and what oversight is there.
Now, the uniform assessment tool, in theory, plans are all using it. One way to, as we talked about, one way to check in the plan is to collect the data from that tool and then evaluate the extent to which, you know, plans are using that tool effectively to determine the level of need. So, you know, clearly, I think that the good thing about comprehensive long-term care benefit is that the plan will not have a financial incentive to put someone in a nursing home unless absolutely, positively necessary as really the option.
Understood.
So I think that we'll have the finances working in our favor.
Not always.
Well, not always. So you think, you know, it's like
they don't
split shift or 24-hour sleep.
There are
maybe
cases where 24-hour community does
work. You're right.
20 hours a month.
And so I think on the assessment, so I guess my question would be, I don't know, Mark, to the extent to which do we think that looking at the back end on the application of the UAT is the way to do that, or obviously there's also appeal. If somebody doesn't want to go there, you know, they can appeal.
Complicate that. Can someone disenroll a beneficiary if they enter a nursing home that's not in network?
Currently, yes. It happens.
But here's the issue alternative. There's no fee for service nursing home benefit, and everything's managed
right.
care.
Right.
That's a fundamental question.
So how would they, in the new world order, how would they, this sort of go at the premise of your question, Carol, so I understand it, but how would they enter?
Well,
enter something that wasn't in the network of their...
I think the question would be, I think that on one hand what they would do is they, obviously the nursing homes have to be part of the benefit, right? So
right.
What are the nursing homes in the network? Then
exactly.
If they don't like the nursing homes in the network, then the question becomes, do they want to switch plans and what policies are in place?
But you've already answered the question because it's part of the benefit.
Yes.
Ergo, whatever transition you're going through to end up in a nursing, whether it's from the hospital, from home care, or from no care, you have to actually go through a process that acknowledges that nursing homes in the New World Order are that benefit is part of a managed care benefit. And that would be in the
network. Which is back to question number one, which is benefit be all long-term care services, which
yeah.
I think is inherently
right.
An advantage of that, is that, you know, it's part of the network.
And actually, walking through that example and going back through to the number one, if it's not part of the package, a lot of things start to unravel very quickly.
Right.
Because I have an incentive if the person gets a little too expensive
right.
in my community-based
right.
setting.
Much, too much unravel.
Move them out of the nursing
right.
home.
Right. Yep.
I'm concerned with switching out of a plan because I want a particular nursing
right.
home.
Right.
Because that could, if I was unscrupulous, I would have
right.
the minimum capacity of two nursing homes. And I'd probably select A, B.
Then our network requirements are not sufficient.
Right.
If we allow you to do that, then we are
but
failing.
But maybe on the acute on the nursing home side, everybody is, all nursing homes will accept a member from any plan. So you get out of that piece with a predetermined, this is the rate.
There's a problem, though. There's a problem on it. I mean, the problem is that all rates are not equal.
That's right.
You pay the Medicaid rate.
No, we don't. All Medicaid rates are not equal.
That's
so,
true, too.
You know, so
that's
if
true.
You negotiate with a number of facilities and you have the required number of as part of your plan, but someone wants to go to a nursing home that's not in your plan, maybe they're part of another plan, maybe they're not in any plan. You know, then the question is what happens at that point for that individual who elects to make that switch. To say to the plan, you must contract with all nursing homes, means that you're not in control of your economic viability. Long-term care fees.
And
that's where the
right.
most expense is going to be.
And also, you credential the nursing home. And
right.
it may be that you don't want a particular nursing
exactly.
home in your network.
Yeah. Right.
right.
See, I think that's the way to do it, is that you have to have a requirement around sufficient nursing home access, but I don't think it's not any other area that you have to have every provider in the network, but you have to have a sufficient number of providers to meet the patient. I think that's where those contract requirements really kick in, is how you define the adequate network. The adequacy of the network will vary based on the size of the plan, so the bigger a plan is, the more enrollment they have, the more providers they'll have to meet the needs. And I think fundamentally that'll come down to the key responsibility of the state will be not only to set those standards, which, you know, advice and counsel from all of you, but then also to make sure that plans are living up to those standards.
I think it becomes less a matter, I mean, it's partly a matter of capacity, but plans are required to provide the benefit even if they don't have the capacity, they're required to provide it out of network. The issue becomes choice, I think, member choice. And that it's different with the nursing home where you're going someplace to live.
Yep.
Right, and you have issues of being near your family, so
yeah,
it gets compounded, right?
Faith, you're right, faith.
Okay, faith, right. Okay.
Can I go back to the I don't know, is the 90-day and then once a year after that in the broader managed care, is that in law or is that a regulation by the DOH?
Is it in law?
That's a
good question. I think some of it is in law, it's in 364J where it defines it. And let me just say that to the extent during the lock-in period, there's still a good cause disenrollment. And so, you know, maybe, you know, when you look at the reasons why a person should be able to break lock-in, that you could create good cause, good disenrollment.
Right, and that's what I was asking is, you know, I don't know if it's 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, or nine, but it seems like there should be some sort of circumstance that allows you to do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And they would always have a good cause system room if you're going to lock a person in. I think CMS requires us to have that. So.
Okay. Mark.
If you allow people to disenroll for an out-of-network provider, try to make sure that I'm not incentivized to advocate to that member to go to an out-of-network provider.
Right. I think that's
right.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
Okay. Number 12, a CCM will be able to serve specified populations. Some populations have unique needs that can be best addressed by an entity that's skilled in the assessment, care plan development, and monitoring of that group, or to address specific medical conditions or illnesses. A CCM should be able to develop and use its expertise to serve specific populations. Yes, Melanie.
We've talked just a little bit. Marilyn and I have both brought up the whole issue of the consumer direction,
right.
The consumer directed program, and the requirement under the statute that this be made available. So we just wanted to specifically address, or at least ask the question of, where are we putting in our principles, and perhaps the place is here, that consumer directed is available to people, that the existing contractors or the existing fiscal intermediaries are going to be contracted with by the plans. And that people are going to have, again, continuity of care between the folks that, you know, they may have been served for years and years, they may be family members in some cases. And the whole issue of, is consumer-directed a potential type of managed or care coordination, folks doing their own care coordination.
So, Mark and Valencia, as you think about it, do you see number 12 as kind of a vehicle to have consumer direction in a particular CCM, or
I think I see it as a separate principle. I mean, it's a good principle. I think it's not extremely confusing as a principle, but it might be an added principle.
Right.
And I think this is also a principle designed to say that providers, like special needs plans, I mentioned the ACE,
right.
As a good example. That is a CCM model that is very focused on a particular provider type. I suspect strongly that our behavioral health work group colleagues will also propose a special needs plan for people with persistent mental illness, and that people who have those diagnoses would have the choice of choosing one of them. Now, in terms of the CDPAP, I think our vision for that is the question is, does CDPAP meet all the requirements as a standalone waiver program across these? I would say no. However, what I think we've said is that we want the idea of self-direction to be embedded into the requirement of the CCM, so that CCMs have to offer, and we have this question, how you define self-direction as an option within that environment.
Okay, that's a little different than the way it's worded in the statute. Marilyn brought up the issue before of the whole issue of who's doing consumer direction.
You're saying where in the statute does it say that the CDPAP
you have to
program?
Offer, no, not the CDPAP program, but it says offer consumer direction, not necessarily. I mean, you know.
The
discussions that we've had have been around the consumer directed personal assistance program.
Right.
We've got 78 some odd fiscal intermediaries out there who are experts in this kind of program. But we also have the issue that Marilyn raised before, the whole issue of home care life, of organizations that aren't really doing consumer direction, but they say they do. And it's not really the model that consumer direction is meant to be.
Absolutely.
And that's the danger if you're just saying the option of self-direction within the context of the plan. We've got a whole great program out there that's working. We can't just toss away the specifics for, some self-direction.
And I agree. I think then what we need to do is to develop principles that clearly says, which I think we got into consumer direction, maybe it wasn't as explicit in any of these, but it sort of, I think, cuts across a number of things. We talked about the need for one on transition, for instance,
right.
And adequacy of network, and we talked about a number of different principles. But I do think that you have to define what self-direction within a plan environment means, and how do we ensure that people who select that option within plans, that you know, that it's meaningful self-direction, but that also is balanced against, you know, helping to ensure that the person's getting the most cost-effective care.
Well, and that's what we've argued. I'm sure you're familiar with the proposals we made earlier this year. The CPAP plan in particular is less expensive. And I think your own data has shown that. So that's
it's still a fee-for-service program.
Understood.
So I think the question is that we're getting out of the fee-for-service business. And the question is, how do you maintain key important elements of the CPAP waiver program? And that's not the only
it's
way.
It's not a waiver. I think you're going a step too far. Right now, we contract as a plan with the contract, as we would provide with any other licensed PCA provider. It's the same. You contract with the provider. It would be the same.
Sure.
With service well managed.
And I think that could very well be the answer right there.
But I think what our concern is that the model of consumer direction, which was developed in New York State, and it's a copy throughout the country, has certain rights and responsibilities and definitions of what makes a provider able to do this. And there's some programs in this state, upstate particularly, where other agencies are running them, but they're using a medical model.
Sure.
And that is not the same thing. And you can't, if you're going to say to a plan, this is an option that you should offer, they can't not offer what the model is. They can't invent their own model. It's called
sure. No. I think there's actually a strong corollary here to health homes again, because in essence what the state will do with health homes is that we're in essence going to certify them as providers, and that for individuals enrolled in health plans will be required for certain populations. They'll be required to enroll those populations into health homes. So the money will still flow through the capitation payments, and the plan provides certain services, but that for other services that are specifically the health homes. So the state, in essence, helps ensure through the certification process that the health homes are meeting our strict criteria for being a health home. You know, I think maybe we need to explore for self-directed programs setting specific criteria that state would either certify or potentially, staff to the extent right now in Mark's area, maybe that could be their role in this new place, is helping certify who meets those standards. And then, you know, the requirement could be that plans, to the extent those providers are available, the plans are contracting with them and then giving people the option to do that. So it sounds to me, that's positive, that plans are already contracting with
One plan.
But at least we've got a model out there that we can take a look at.
One plan. Okay. Dave, you have the final comment on that. Right.
How long will they be given to develop expertise in all these other areas, or will that expertise be required in their contract to begin with?
It's required. We have to set the contract. They've got to meet the requirements day one of the contract. And I think what we've said is that we're going to basically a 3-year phase out of managed care, with the idea being that we've published a schedule that suggests, hey, some of the more complex programs will be in the second and third year. So I think that it gives plans sufficient time to, and gives us sufficient time to make sure that the contracts reflect the unique needs of whether it's the CPAP population or the brain injury waiver population, certain new populations. But then, you know, the plans also have some unique challenges. Network requirements. Okay,
Joe? As we get into specific subpopulations, and then going back to the whole issue of risk adjustment models, there may need to be totally different risk adjustment models.
With the population, all right.
Yep.
All right, what I would like to do is just, as we conclude these 12 principles, I'd just like to go around once and make sure that we hear some concluding thoughts from each and every one of you, and then we'll sum up next steps. There's quite a few to talk about. But Dave, do you have any concluding observations to make?
A couple of housekeeping things first.
if we're going to have more than the three meetings, and if we ever have meetings here in the Capital District, yeah, I'm more than happy to host them in my larger, comfortable.
Is it free?
Yes,
okay.
I appreciate getting the materials that we're going to discuss sooner than 24 hours before the meeting.
I think
more prepared or better prepared. But having said that, I guess I finish where I start, but I am concerned as I listen to the conversation and read. I don't think we can say person-centered enough from the side. There's a lot of conversation about the needs of the CCM and of the institutions and of the payers and of the providers. And this, the whole document, to me, doesn't really reflect the idea that this is person-centered first. It goes back to my overarching concern that, you know, coordinated care can be a great thing. It can improve quality, and that's what I am most interested in seeing. If it's done just to save money first and then we'll try to make it quality as we go, again, that's not the way coordinated care should be done. That's not what we're doing. So the more we can focus on the patient or the consumer throughout the entire process,
thank you. Helen?
I would just say I think that the issues that were raised today are really crucial to making this project a success, and as we all hope to see it be. And so the more that the workers in particular can get into detail and flesh this out, I think that will help us be prepared for what are going to be big changes.
Okay, Joanne?
I'll defer judgment about whether we've made any progress today on the question of my still strong belief that you have to have multiple models to recognize the multiple differences throughout the state, and that one model is not going to necessarily work in all communities. And I'm hoping that future versions of this shows a greater possibility.
Okay, Kate.
I agree with Joanne on that. I think, it is what it is. We are moving from fee to service to this. It seems that we are focusing on insurance-based one-size-fits-all MLCC and not putting, things that are not broken upstate in other areas that are working well, the consumer-directed programs, some other long-term home health care programs, just shoving them aside in the face of just saying, let's get this done, instead of saying, you know what, if downstate needs something fixing, let's not rush ruin a whole bunch of things that are working well and are cost-effective in other areas of the state, just for simply to put this tag on it that it is a managed long-term care product.
Okay, Michael.
I think that a lot of the concerns that have been expressed were expressed earlier in the discussion as reasons to not go down this road. But I think that now that we're down this road, and that revisiting that decision is not part of the scope of this work group, I think a lot of those concerns still have great applicability, and we can use them to good effect to make this a better road. If I can steal a second brief thought, the devil is going to be in the details in fleshing out and operationalizing a lot of these principles. So the quicker we can move past discussion of whether or not we have started down this road, and we have, the quicker we can get to the operational details that I think are going to be pivotal.
Harold?
I think this has been a good process. I am simultaneously involved in the OPWDD design, and it's quite different. The difference is that as they uncover challenges, their intention is to solve them. And I would just support the work group and anything that arises tractable, so we put a group of people together to figure out how best to solve that so we can be as efficient as possible going forward. It's not to minimize the concerns. I just think there's ways to arrive at solutions for those concerns. It may not be perfect, but there will be solutions.
All right, Mary.
I think that I guess my concerns are kind of on the margins. I think the whole idea of person-centered care and presumes a population that is somewhat better prepared than most people are now to know about what they're heading into, and to be, and so the whole idea of consumer education and more or less preparing people earlier on to enter this system and getting them ready for their contact is, I think, important before the assessment process begins. And then I worry also, I think also about that we can't forget the intersection of this new care coordination models and with the other social services that are on the ground and existing throughout the state, and making the best use of the interfaces between those systems so that we don't overload them with the most difficult cases, or find a way to integrate them and pay for them.
Mark?
I agree with what Jason said in the beginning and the opening, as well as what Michael just reaffirmed. I think the details are very important in fleshing out just the basic principles besides getting into the operational. I think that will provide far greater clarity and purpose when you and Eli articulate that at the overall MRT, and I think it'll be more meaningful. A couple of other thoughts regarding there can't be age discrimination. Plans cannot, as they currently are, able to choose to be licensed for under 65 or over 65. And that's an issue that really needs before April 1st, because that becomes a real issue for whomever, and it's just not, in my belief, appropriate. I think there also has to be a ramp up embedded in the overall principles. And I think we've reflected that verbally, but I can't. Its importance is extremely critical, both programmatically as well as financially. I think the infrastructure of the SDOH has got to be embedded in these principles to make sure that what we're all expressing as concerns, fears, anxiety, particularly from the consumer perspective, that they're addressed. And also the plans that are licensed and certified, it'll go smoother in that rollout. I think that the incentives have got to be there, both the incentives to do right, the incentive to provide quality, and to be recognized for that. I think that none of us, I think, I've never heard myself or anybody that I know saying, you know, in those golden years, make sure I get into that nursing home. I want to be in that skilled nursing facility no matter what. For many years to come, I want to be there with the greatest degree of respect for the skilled nursing facility. I think that we all have to be mindful of the resource and the capabilities of, Jason, your vision of having a chronic individual patient member in a skilled nursing and transitioning out of that, out to where. And I think that may be phase three of what we do to develop those other avenues, because there's a reason why they got in there to begin with. I don't know if they're going to go out in a community type of setting or a non-SNP institutional setting.
Okay.
I would echo what David said and what Joanne said about sort of the importance of the idea of a person-centered model, and also the idea that multiple models to serve the variety of populations. I also think that to agree with Mark and Michael, that the devil really is in the details. And to the extent possible, particularly for the sort of appeals and consumer protection group, that what they hammer out is sort of incorporated to the extent possible into the guiding principles to kind of flesh out really what the flesh out the principles.
Okay.
I guess my thoughts would be I represent that small upstate rural county that's been talked a little bit about, conceptual here today. And both Jason and Mark, I think, spoke to the fact that there's going to need to be openness and flexibility as we go forward. But to Joanne's point, there are communities that I suspect there may only be a nursing home as the only long-term care provider there, and we need to acknowledge that and understand it, you know, going into this process. And both Mark and Mary spoke too about education needed for consumers. The decision gets made to come to a nursing home at the bedside after an incident occurred that nobody ever planned for. So the issue of education for consumers around what long-term care means, because if you went out in the community today and asked people what long-term care is, I bet you get 25 different responses based on an individual experience that somebody has had. And I think the flexibility also is important as you look across the state where informal systems have evolved over time out of necessity to meet needs that may now be able to be formalized in some way as a part of this process that, again, are going to be unique to different regions and different parts of the state.
I will thank you that if you ask somebody, how do you cover your long-term care needs, they will tell you they have a Medicare card.
Yes. Okay, Kathy.
I think I would be cautious about making a distinction between, as we did to some degree in the conversation today, between the health home and the care coordination model. Setting aside whether or not we qualify under the federal rule, really what's at the core of the health home is the whole person approach, and I think that is the patient-centered approach, and I don't know how to coordinate care without coordinating care for the whole person. So, you know, whether we technically meet that model, I really think we have to think about care coordination in a broader context rather than in a narrow context.
Hey, Melanie.
That wasn't what I was going to say, but that's a great point. And one of the things that struck me about the health homes that the department has been rolling it out is they've specifically been talking about the need for housing, and maybe that housing is the most important barrier that individual has to maintaining their health, and that's critical to this group as well, obviously. I certainly would, you know, echo David and everybody else who talked about a person-driven process. I hope we can maintain, I know we can maintain existing care hearing and other rights that we have, but also find a way to concretize, you know, how the state's requirement under Homestead is implemented in the community by providers. The upstate-downstate thing is really big for us. As you know, Consumer Directed is much bigger upstate than downstate. That's a really important service. I would hope we don't throw out either CDPHCA or the Nursing Facility Transition and Diversion waiver as well. Those models are working in our world, but there are barriers that we know how to change those. And I would just underline also the whole issue of education. I think we have talked a bit about like options counseling for people going into plans if they have enough information. There are groups out there that are specifically doing that kind of counseling already that are available both to provide it and to, you know, provide information about how that works, particularly in the older and younger disability population.
Okay. Alan?
I think one principle that I'd like to see us focus is that comprehensive care coordination results in better care. The purpose and the motive for doing this is improving care. Secondary benefit of that is it's going to be less costly. Good care costs less. You know, that's a driving concept. I think there are two groups of people, that need protection. One is obviously the consumer. And I think that the existing system doesn't build in sufficient protection. Yes, there are automatic rights to hearing and everything else, but by not being able to provide the timing, in denying them their rights, they're also disadvantaging the plans. And plans have a right to be financially viable. Their viability is threatened when people are able to get care that may not be appropriate or necessary. But the plan is a question. So I think that those two things go together, and it also ties in with risk adjustment. Timeliness of risk adjustment also is a element of viability. As we look at other groups, there has to be a depression expert. I guess that was kind of cute the way they said it. But obviously what they're talking about is if you're going to deal with depressed people, you have to have people in your plan to know what that is and how to deal with it. That applies here also. And certainly on specialty populations and needs and some of the others. If the plan is going to take on responsibilities and care for that individual, have to have the infrastructure and the knowledge and skills to do this, and not not assume that all tribes are equal. They're not. There are differences among them between us.
Hey, Betty.
Overall, I think the thing that we all need to recognize is that managed care is good quality, safe care when it's done properly. But in order to make sure that it is implemented in a successful way in New York, we really need to make sure that there's minimum resources and capacity in each and every area that we attempt to implement it. I think that the adequacy of the network is critical. And while Mark says no one goes around saying, I really want to go to that nursing home, I can assure you there are people who say, if I have to go to a nursing home, I want to go to X. And we need to make sure that we allow that consumer choice so that they have access to X. Because if I'm going to be someplace for the last 6 months of my life, the last 18 months of my life, and I am of a particular faith, I need to have access.
Joe?
I think there was already a healthy, broad discussion. A lot of good ideas, issues, important issues. I think, and I especially agree with what Alan and Betty were just saying, I think we've got consensus around the primary importance of involving the consumer, ensuring continuity of care, continuity of services. I think there's actually a modification to the principles that are here or somewhere between capitation, risk adjustment, responsibility for care coordination, care delivery, and it really goes to the issue of viability of the care coordination model for organizations. I'm not sure how to ensure their viability, but the last thing we want to do is put out a new model and have a number of organizations fail with resulting disruptions in service and so forth. And so I'm not sure what the mechanisms are that are put in place here.
Self-directing, who've been managing the service quite well for many years. you know, and not take that and hand this away from people, but at the same time, being there to fill in the gaps to help better coordinate the services. And it becomes a greater challenge when we do our job right and we try to convert coordinate services in a huge setting into the community. Whereas a managed long term care plan, if they're not paying for the services, they're not going to listen to you. You know, so there was a challenge. One thing I'd like the committee to, I feel strongly that there are different groups in the population that receive long term care services. There's elderly people, I know some of them, people with cognitive disabilities, or AKA developmental disabilities, and people both younger and older with physical disabilities without cognitive issues. And I think that the way you provide those services, what services you provide, and how you reimburse for them, and all becomes important because you need to look at the population you're serving. And I really think that if we want to look at this right, we should look at the different costs for the different models and have them used based on the population. And I just think it's important. I mean, for someone to go into Jewish Guild and go and as a visual impairment, they're likely to get what they need because of the expertise.
figure out a way that we can tackle it, and that's
transition issues. And we've heard from Helen about the continuity. We've heard from Joanne about the capacity and how do you take something that's working and how do you move it toward where we're headed. And we need to think about how to deal with some of those transition issues, which we will try to do. So those are the next steps. So let me ask Mark and Valencia, are there other things that we should be sharing with the work group at this point?
No, I just say the public hearing on the 19th is going to be at the New York City College of Technology in Brooklyn, where the Brooklyn hearing was. It's a venue that literally disappeared as we're meeting today. So that'll be on the website. We'll get all the information out on that. But just it's a downstate public hearing. We'll figure out how to organize that and look forward to people participating in that. If you have additional
question, Mark, is
sure.
The expectation that all the committee members will be present?
Well, I think that is the goal, that we have as many as possible at that presentation. If people can make it, that'd be great. If people can't make it, then we will try to figure out ways to facilitate that, either through, I don't know. I'm not sure we do webcasting, but we'll do some sort of
webcasting for the Brooklyn hearing, but I'll have to check.
Yeah, so we'll try to do webcasting. If we can't, if not, we'll do summaries or allow people to participate. And any information that's presented, we can also get to around to the committee, if you can't make it. But the better the showing, the better showing they have the members, I think the better the work group will look in the public eye. No, not yet.
Can I make a request for reasonable accommodation?
Absolutely.
A lot of people with disabilities will have trouble getting there for 9 or 10 a.m.
Okay. I mean, the tentative time was 11, but that's not done yet, so we'll send that out to everyone on that one. I would ask that people, if they have additional comments on the principles, once we send them out again, or in the interim, too, please email Valencia and I, and we can look at that. Yeah, I mean, we'll look at that. If you're at Betty's facility, she's volunteering your facility. No, wait.
I have a very large auditorium.
Yeah, we could try. I mean, we'll try. Mm-hmm. We'll try. I mean,
Well, if we can do that, we probably ought to divide the work groups and have,
right.
Some cohort go upstate and some downstate. We'll
try. We can't accept that.
I think you're here vastly different.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
What you do here.
We'll try to come in.
Okay. Anything you want to
No,
add?
I think
that's it. So let me just go over the work group, and we will also be emailing you with schedules. So the first work group, which is on Fields and Fair hearings, which Eli is going to shepherd, and I think you're aiming for end of August, the first meeting. Right. The people who signed up for that are Mark Lane, Marilyn, Valerie, we have several outside people. I'm not going to mention all the outside people right now. We have a number of them. But I'm just going to mention the work group members, Melanie, Alan, and Carol. And then there were several for each of these where outsiders were interested, and we're going to call through all of the outsiders who are interested. And to the extent possible, we will involve outsiders. Yes.
Could I suggest somebody from who works at the fair hearing? Now,
yeah,
like the leader.
Yeah,
the director of fair hearing.
Okay, right.
So
well,
at least somebody will know what they're talking about.
All right, Mark, just give us that and speak.
Yeah,
you don't know who that is.
Oh, I don't know who it is.
I have a couple people. All
right, okay.
Maybe Mary's got the right person.
Okay, the director of fair hearing.
We'll figure that out.
Quality, I have Betty, Kate, Joe, Kathy, Michael, Courtney, George Gresham, or representative, and David McNally. And then I have a number of outside people who express interest, and we will call some names from that as well. And then on the crossover group, I have Doug, Mary, Michael, and again, an outside person who's interested. Is there anyone who hasn't signed up? Joette.
I'll be following.
Okay.
Carol, is it the crossover?
Crossover, okay.
Carol?
Hang on one second. Just want to be sure that we get all the names here. Yes.
Is it possible to be on more than
subcommittee?
It is.
I'd like to sign up for the quality.
Okay. So, Jason, any concluding inspirational remarks for us?
No, other than thank you. It's been great. It's been a fantastic conversation, so I'm glad I had an opportunity.
Carol, I'm sorry. I'm one moment. And of the three work groups, which I forgot about, we've only got one more scheduled meeting on the 28th.
That's correct. Right.
Is that sufficient time that we have allocated to complete and have a final report? And I know that the behavioral has been expanded, and I know people's time is valuable, and all that goes in the coordination of the meeting, but I'm concerned that there's a lot to cover, and what Michael and I and Jason, you reflected relative to the details, perhaps there should be consideration of an additional meeting besides just the last scheduled one for the 28th of September.
Jason, when do we have to formally report?
October 15th is when your report is due, but you would not actually have to report until... As I said, the meeting for when you'd actually report to the MRT will probably be even later in the month of October into early November. So I think you do have time if you want to schedule a meeting.
Okay. Why don't we take a look and see if we can do one more in early, in October.
Okay.
Okay?
Yep.
In the meantime, I'm eager to get the subcommittees rolling, so we will try to work on scheduling those meetings as well. So thank you all for your thoughts and contributions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello. I'm sitting next to your
mark.
My mother's talking about it.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So,
you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to basically just have a car wash. I guess the thing is that I don't know if the system, everything in the system has to be at that level that they want.
Yeah,
The only thing I think I'll use the, it's not a good example necessarily, but say elder plan, you know, where Randy is now getting himself to, you know, his meeting with some people, but, you know, like Representative Graham, but it's been a hard road to get there. And, you know, I think that the perfect example actually was when I first went to Haney and I was doing media relations. I was all excited and I ran into Dan's office one day. Dan, you kind of want to talk to him. And he looks at me and goes, you can do it. Yeah, but that's not the point. The point is, you're the CEO, and the New York Times wants to talk to you. And, you know, my job was just making that arrangement. Yeah. It's not me that should be. I'll make the connection, but it's not me that should be.
I think what's important, and when you run into problems like that, I need to be aware of it. Because I can't play my role on the other side unless I'm aware of it.
The leader has disconnected. The conference will now...